Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of the channel, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books, and we interview the authors of those books. And this week, I'm happy to say we have David Williams on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific book, I Freed Myself, African-American Self-Emancipation in the Civil War Era. David, thank you for being on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Great. Could you kick off the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I've been teaching at Valdosta State University since about 1988. I'm from the South generally. I'm sort of an Army brat. We lived a number of places. But I suppose living in the South, growing up in the South, it's hard to get away from history. It's on kind of every street corner, every courthouse square. And even growing up, I don't think I was real comfortable with the versions of history I was seeing because it didn't always match the faces around me. It was largely white history, but black history was sort of missing from the equation. And even as a young person, I think I got that. It was only later on in college and graduate school that I got little bits and pieces of what I thought I was missing. Got interested in that and just researched more about it. Ended up, for various reasons, I think, majoring in or having my major fields in Southern history, Old South generally, Civil War in particular. And I think that sort of missing history that I felt I was wasn't getting at growing up, I sort of gravitated toward that. And I think that this book is sort of the culmination of that.
So tell us why you wrote I Freed Myself, African-American Self-Emancipation in the Civil War Era. Why this book and not some other?
Well, largely because I think a growing disconnect between what I was coming to know as a graduate student and as a professor, and what my students didn't seem to know. I guess it largely, to an extent, focused on Lincoln, but I didn't really want to focus the book on Lincoln because the book's not about Lincoln. It's about the contributions of African Americans to the growing sectional crisis, the freedom process, but I don't know, my students just didn't seem to be terribly aware of that. In fact, a few years ago when I first started working on this book, for my incoming freshman students in my U.S. History Survey classes, first day of class I would have them write an essay about their understanding of the whole emancipation process, and it largely boiled down to, well, Lincoln wrote the Emancipation Proclamation, freed the slaves, and that was sort of that. There were a few that did seem to have a sense that African Americans were at least marginally involved in the process, but nobody seemed to have at least my students didn't seem to have a clear understanding of that, despite the fact that, you know, for decades, historians have been emphasizing the role of blacks in the process, at least to some extent. I think some historians still tend to focus on Lincoln because he's just a fascinating figure. I mean, I think biography of any sort is fascinating to readers generally and historians in particular. But African Americans are very, very intimately involved in the emancipation process, not just during the Civil War, but before the Civil War and bringing on the Civil War. And it's not as if Americans of the Civil War era weren't aware of that. I mean, the whole issue of African Americans in the Army was a huge issue at the time, and everybody knew that there had been, you know, a couple of hundred thousand African Americans involved in the U.S. military. It's really only in the post-war period that sort of seems to be written out of the general narrative of history, with sort of white Northerners claiming to have sort of erased the sin of slavery from the nation. To such an extent that by the time we get into the early 20th century, you have this one biography of Grant, in which the author wrote that, and I'm quoting here, that Negroes, or paraphrasing, that Negroes were the only people in the history of the world that never lifted a finger to free themselves. They just sat around twanging banjos and singing songs and waiting for some Yankee to come along and free them. And that really wasn't the case at all. African Americans, enslaved African Americans, were intimately involved in the freedom process by the act of escape, by the act of resistance within the South during the war. And that's a story that just never seemed to really get into the general narrative. Mm-hmm. I think even these days, when I poll my students about that, they just don't seem to quite be aware of it. So that's mainly the reason I wrote this book, to try to increase awareness of the role of African Americans in the freedom process.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let's begin to tell the story by setting the stage, and I hope you don't mind if I rehearse some of these things that I think most people who listen to this podcast will know. And I guess the very first one, and this again is the traditional view, it puts Lincoln at the center of it. When Lincoln was elected president, he was openly hostile to slavery. Correct?
Certainly openly hostile to the expansion of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
He actually repeatedly said in 1860 during the presidential campaign that he was no threat to slavery where it existed directly. He just didn't want to see see slavery expanded. Now he never said slavery was right, and in private writings, he was very, very forthright about his feeling that slavery was wrong. But as a matter of public policy, he was very, very open about not wanting to see slavery expanded into the territory,
mm-hmm.
but stressing that he was no threat to slavery where it existed. And this wasn't just aimed at a Southern audience to try to dissuade white Southerners from supporting secession. It was aimed at a Northern audience, too, that although they, although white Northerners tended to oppose the expansion of slavery for a variety of both economic and racist reasons, they largely tended to support slavery where it existed in the South, again, for both economic and racist reasons. It kept most blacks trapped in the South. White Northerners were generally very much opposed to black immigration to the North because they thought it threatened jobs, and, again, for racist reasons as well. And so Lincoln knows he's got that to deal with also. But through the 1850s, the crux between slaveholders in the South and white Northerners generally tends to be the issue of expansion mm-hmm. of slavery into the territories. Not so much because slaveholders are real eager to take slavery into the territories, but because they're largely feeling pressure from slaves in the South themselves. Slave resistance is on the rise. Not so much outright rebellion, because that's sort of collective suicide. But individual acts of resistance, including subtle resistance like feigning ignorance, feigning illness, but all the way to slaves being pushed to outright murder of slaveholders. That was on the rise in the 1850s. And so slaveholders are becoming increasingly nervous about slave resistance, and growing numbers of slaves who are increasingly resistant. And so they're looking for ways to expand slavery into the Western territories. Again, not because they themselves are eager to go into the Western territories, because I think most slaveholders were generally educated and generally aware that the Western territories just weren't suitable for large-scale cotton agriculture. But on the other hand, slaveholders in the South only constitute 25% of the white population, 75% of Southern whites owned no slaves at all. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that that slaveholders are struggling with is the question of how do you keep 75% of the white population supporting slavery if they don't own slaves? One factor in that is encouraging racism. Another factor is encouraging the expansion of slavery into the territories, or at least keeping the idea of the expansion of slavery into the territories open, essentially telling white Southerners that who didn't own slaves, that 75% who largely couldn't afford land, couldn't afford slaves, mainly because land was becoming increasingly scarce in the South, telling these folk, well, look, even if you can't afford good land in the South, we'll keep slavery open in the territories, and you can afford land out there, and because the price of slaves is largely tied to the price of land, if the price of land goes down, maybe the price of slaves will go down. So even if you don't own slaves in the South, you can own slaves in the West. So keep supporting slavery. We're going to open up slavery in the West. Northerners, on the other hand, are largely opposed to that, especially the poor factory workers in the North who don't view factory work in the 19th century as anything to be envious of, and largely view a rural existence as something that they would like to have, that they would like to buy themselves a farm or get cheap land in the West, because land prices in the North by that time were going up as well. No, or very few factory workers were ever going to have enough money to buy enough land to live on. And so they're looking forward, many of them, to expanding, to moving into the West, setting up homesteads for themselves. And when they do that, when they get there, they don't want to have to compete with slave labor. And again, for racist reasons, they just don't want blacks in the West generally. And Northerners generally, certainly businessmen, financiers, anybody who has wealth in the North, either owns a textile factory or has investments in textile factories. In fact, in 1860, the biggest industry in the North is the textile industry, and the biggest part of that textile industry is the cotton textile industry. The cotton's coming from the South. It's being produced by slave labor. Northern financiers and manufacturers generally tend not to openly oppose slavery, and some even to support it, because it keeps cheap cotton flowing to the North. But again, they don't want to see slavery expanded to the West, because they view the West as an area of vast natural resources that they want to exploit for themselves, and they don't want to have to compete with slaveholders for that land. I think that's a lesser aspect of it. The more politically volatile aspect of it has to do with the vast majority of white Northerners who, again, although they don't really oppose slavery in the South, they don't want to see it expanded into the West. Now, how do the blacks play into all of this? Well, by the time we get into the 1850s, lots of blacks are escaping to the North. That's putting pressure on northern whites who, again, don't want to see blacks migrating to the North, although they're escaping there anyway. And they're being followed by slave catchers, and who are sort of turning the North into a battlefield over slavery. Northerners frequently respond with personal liberty laws that basically say to slave catchers, you know, we don't want your kind here. Don't make the North a battleground over slavery. And they certainly want to keep slavery out of the territory. So, again, getting back to Lincoln, this is what he's facing in 1860. White Northerners who don't necessarily oppose slavery where it exists, but don't want to see it expanded into the territories. And slaves are constantly putting pressure on that fault line between freedom and slavery by escaping to the North when opportunity presents. And slaveholders, on the other hand, are trying to press for the expansion of slavery in the Western Territory. So that's where the real crux comes. Mm-hmm. In fact, in terms of preserving slavery in the South, Congress in early 1861, as the secession crisis is going on, as Southern states one by one are leaving the Union, they're desperate for compromise to keep keep particularly the cotton states in the Union, and Congress is under a lot of pressure from Northern financiers to keep the Deep South in the Union, to keep the cotton-producing states in the Union, because if they're out of the Union, the least that's going to mean is that cotton prices are going to go up because of export taxes, import taxes. The worst it could mean, and this was viewed by some as a possibility, could be a cotton embargo on the North, which would ruin the North's largest industry. So there's that fear among Northern industrialists. So they're putting pressure on Congress to keep the cotton states in the Union by compromise if possible, by force if necessary, you know, just whatever it takes. And one compromise that was offered, one that actually was passed through Congress, the only one that was actually passed through Congress, was something called the Corwin Amendment, issued by an Ohio congressman, Republican congressman named Corwin. It passed the Senate, it passed the House of Representatives, it was sent out to the states for ratification, and this amendment would have guaranteed slavery in the South, in the states where it already existed, would have guaranteed it forever. Hmm. And actually, there was a provision in the Corwin Amendment that said that no subsequent amendment to the Constitution could wipe out the Corwin Amendment. this would have been the 13th Amendment.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Congress, both houses of Congress passed that amendment with a Republican majority.
That's remarkable.
And even more remarkable is just as this was being sent out to the states, March 4th, 1861, Lincoln's first inaugural address, he actually mentions the Corwin Amendment and says, I fully support such an amendment. Have no objection to making slavery permanent and irrevocable in the states where it already exists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So here you've got Lincoln, you know, desperate to avoid civil war, desperate to compromise, coming into office saying, hey, I'm fully supportive of guaranteeing slavery in the slave states forever, as long as that helps preserve the Union. And that's his primary objective, preserving the Union, keeping the cotton states in the Union by whatever means necessary. So really, as we get into 1861 to 62, the story I'm most interested in, and this is sort of the heart of the book, although I go from the pre-war period to the post-war period. The heart of the book deals with, or one major theme of the book deals with, the period between Lincoln's inauguration in March of 1861 and the Emancipation Proclamation just over a year later. I mean, how is it that Lincoln moves from supporting a 13th Amendment that would have guaranteed slavery forever to an Emancipation Proclamation by September of the next year?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let's stop just there for a second. That was a very good correction to what I said. And incidentally, your mention of the expansion of slavery and the issue of expansion of slavery reminds me of a bumper sticker that I saw. I'm from Kansas. A bumper sticker that I saw once that said, Kansas protecting people against Missouri since 1854.
And that's largely what leaving Kansas was all about in 1855, 1856.
Yeah, it was a little
miniature civil war that was going on in Kansas.
A little interstate rivalry there, protecting people against Missouri. So let me just ask one more basic question, just so we know exactly where we are. And again, this is something that I think needs to be cleared up. I don't know if that's the right word. Lincoln gets elected, and it is because Lincoln gets elected that the South succeeds?
That's the precipitating factor.
Okay.
But getting back to the point I was making a minute
yes,
ago,
go ahead.
The question of how does Lincoln move from being a supporter of the Corwin Amendment, one that would an amendment to a 13th Amendment to the Constitution that would have guaranteed slavery forever in the states that exist where it existed? How did he move from that in March of 1861 to the Emancipation Proclamation or the Preliminary Proclamation in September of 62? And largely the answer to that question is African-Americans themselves, because early in the war, Lincoln makes the point that, again, he continues making the point, I'm no threat to slavery where it exists. This is not a war to free the slaves. This is only a war to preserve the Union. Congress backs him up in that with the Johnson-Crittenden Amendment or resolution saying that this is a war, again, to preserve the Union, not to free the slaves. And early on, when slaves try to escape to Union lines, Lincoln's orders to the army are to turn them away, mm-hmm. return, send them back to the farm, as one general put it.
Mm-hmm. But let me pause just for 1 second and ask a question that I'm sure people are asking. If it is the case, and I'm sure it is the case, that Lincoln again and again said, I'm not interested in dismantling slavery at all, and in fact, we'll sign an amendment that makes it permanent, but why did the South succeed?
It goes back to that expansion issue.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the slaveholders, only 25% of the population in the South, 75% of white Southerners are not slaveholders.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking for anything they can grab hold to keep non-slaveholders supporting slavery and to give slaves less free territory to escape into.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they can make three quarters of the country slave territory, they certainly want to do that. And in 1857, the Supreme Court obliges with the Dred Scott case that not only says that slavery can exist in the territories, that slaves can carry their slaves into the territories, but it also decides, and it's no surprise that this should be the case, since most of the Supreme Court's members at that time, I believe it was 7 of the 9, were actually Southerners or connected in some way with slaveholding families.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they said under the terms of the Fifth Amendment, slaves are property. Property can be carried anywhere the Constitution holds force, including the free states. The Dred Scott actually wipes out the whole concept of a free state. Under Dred Scott, there are no
mm-hmm.
free states and slave states. They're all slave states.
Mm-hmm.
Slaveholders are kind of getting what they want from the Supreme Court, very much getting what they want. But just 3 years earlier, after the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which had done away with the Missouri Compromise, which allowed for the possibility of slavery in Kansas and Nebraska, Northerners had been flocking to this new political party called the Republican Party that was dedicated to keeping slavery out of the territories. It was composed of mainly old-line Whigs, some Democrats, a few old abolitionist Liberty Party men who could kind of stomach making an alliance with people who weren't against slavery but just wanted to keep it out of the territories. And here you've got this new Republican Party that won most of the states in the North in the 1856 election. And after Dred Scott, even more Northerners sort of flocked to the Republican Party. And so for some white Southerners, particularly slaveholders, the handwriting seems to be on the wall. I think for those who are politically astute, they get this sort of creeping feeling that, well, as more Northerners flock to the Republican Party because they're promising to keep slavery out of the territories, the next president's probably going to be a Republican. And the one after that and the one after that, because the North outnumbers the South in terms of voting strength by 2-1.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've gotten what we wanted in the Dred Scott case, Southerners are saying, particularly slaveholders. But that really can't last forever, because at some point, you know, the president, as vacancies become available on the Supreme Court, some Republican president is going to appoint some justice and another justice and another justice that's going to overturn Dred Scott.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be difficult to overturn Dred Scott, because the court based the Dred Scott decision on the Fifth Amendment. It said, you know, no one can be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The Supreme Court at the time defined due process of law as essentially, you know, maybe putting someone on trial, depriving them of property because they committed some crime. But a future court could define due process of law as simply the legislature declaring that this is free territory or a free state.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, if some Republican president kept nominating justices to the Supreme Court that would rule in that way, then at some point, the ability of slaveholders to push this issue of slavery in the territories was just going to go away,
yeah.
Which would rob them of a major tool that they had to keep white non-slaveholders supporting slavery. And so they see the handwriting on the wall. At some point, you know, slavery is going to be limited to the South, and a mantra among slaveholders is that slavery must expand or die.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see.
And not just because of white non-slaveholders, but because of slaves themselves. They knew the slaves were increasingly escaping, not just permanently, but temporarily as well. Temporary escapes could turn into permanent escapes. If slavery is, the more restricted slavery is, the easier it's going to be for African Americans to escape. And so they're really worried about this issue of, well, you know, the Republican Party in the North is growing. We need to get out of the Union if a Republican president is elected. Even if he's not a threat directly to slavery, he is a future threat to the expansion of slavery, which is a threat to slavery itself, because of this mantra of slavery must expand or die.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So then basically the South refused Lincoln's proposal of compromise.
Well, by the time the Corwin Amendment was passed,
mm-hmm.
Seven of the Deep South states had
already seceded. Yeah,
despite opposition to it. I mean, there were
mm-hmm.
In Georgia, for example, the vote was very close. In fact, a very slight majority of Georgia voters actually opposed seceding from the Union.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
but South Carolina had already seceded.
Mm-hmm.
Alabama and Mississippi had already seceded. So had Florida. So the Georgia Convention actually took the state out of the Union despite the vote.
Mm-hmm.
Really, only in Alabama, Mississippi, and South Carolina can we say with any certainty that a majority of voters supported taking their states out of the Union. In Louisiana, it's questionable, and Texas is very questionable, and Florida, certainly questionable. In Georgia, it seems to be a slight majority voting against secession.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time we get to the Corwin Amendment, the Deep South has already formed the Confederate States of America. And at that point, you know, you've got a whole cadre of politicians dedicated to keeping the Confederacy in existence,
yeah.
and feeling that they can probably do so, especially after Lincoln calls for 75,000 volunteers after the firing on Fort Sumter, and Tennessee, North Carolina, Virginia, Arkansas, they secede from the Union as well. So it looks like it's going to be an uphill battle for Lincoln, and it is for a long time, largely because of the slavery issue and the question of what do we do with all these hundreds of thousands of escaping slaves? And this is really gets to the crux of the book.
Yeah, let's actually concentrate on that now, and let's get us to the, that was all more or less background. What I want to understand is, and you've explained it very well in your book, and I want the listeners to understand, is how it is the case that these slaves escape, and where they go, how they are received, and how their presence affects Lincoln's thinking on the issue of emancipation.
Yeah, this is something that evolves over a period of more than a year, from early 1861 to about mid to late 1862. And it's, to some extent, still not even settled then. Early in the war, you know, Lincoln makes the point, and Congress makes the point, this is not a war against slavery, only a war to preserve the Union. And that being the case, and they consider secession illegal, therefore these states are still in the Union, the Union, all laws of the United States still hold forth, including the Fugitive Slave Act of 1860, which obligated Northern law enforcement to assist in returning escaping slaves, including officers of the U.S. Army. So when, early in the war, when slaves escape to Union lines, which they do by the tens of thousands from the spring of 1861 on, from the very beginning of the war, Northern Army officers try to turn them away. Say, no, this is not a war against slavery. You're not free. Go back to the plantation. The problem they face, of course, is that, you know, they're escaping largely from behind Confederate lines. And Black says, well, good luck making me go back. You're going to take me through the Confederate Army to get there? And the problem is they just won't go back. They refuse to be enslaved. And in May of 1861, you know, faced with that refusal of blacks to be re-enslaved, to go back into slavery, certainly they're not going voluntarily, Ben Butler, Union general, who ironically isn't a Republican, he's a Democrat. He had actually, at the Democratic Convention, supported Jefferson Davis, of all people, for President of the United States. But now he's a politically appointed general in Virginia. In May of 1861 at Fortress Monroe on the Chesapeake Coast. And he's saying, well, we've got all of these slaves escaping to our lines. Even if we could send them back, you know, what are the Confederates going to do with them? Well, they're going to grow food for the Confederacy. They're going to grow. They're going to be put to work on fortifications. Let's call these folk contraband of war, and let them and keep them ourselves. Put them to work on Union fortifications. Secretary of War Simon Cameron, who's a pretty strong abolitionist himself, he fully supports this policy. And Congress finally comes around to it by August with what was called the First Confiscation Act, saying that, okay, blacks who escape the Union lines, they will be considered essentially contraband of war. You know, blacks weren't particularly happy with that designation because that doesn't make them free. It kind of really puts them in a, those who successfully escape, puts them in sort of a legal limbo. They're not, the federal government still considers them slaves. They are the property of their owners whom they have escaped from. But the federal government can't really return them to their owners at the moment, so we're just going to consider them contraband of war. But what does that mean? Are they to be paid a salary? Are they still slaves? Technically they are, but what does that mean? Does that mean the federal government, and by implication Abraham Lincoln, does that mean they're the biggest slaveholder in the country? Just because we can't return these folk to slavery, what is their legal status? So that's real confusing. And the wording of the First Confiscation Act, while on the surface it seemed somewhat direct, it was difficult to implement. Because because Union commanders in the field had various opinions of how this should be enforced, how it should be interpreted. Some were trying to turn slaves away. Others were accepting escaped slaves, trying to say, well, we don't really We'll use them for labor, but we don't need all of you, so we'll accept some, but not others. But that didn't matter. What really mattered was the fact that there were tens of thousands, eventually hundreds of thousands of slaves escaping to the Union lines and demanding a response. Basically, every slave who escaped slavery in those early months, this was a personal declaration of their own freedom. And it forces the Lincoln administration to respond to this in some way. And initially, it's a very confused response. And it's certainly causing confusion on the ground. What do we do with all these slaves, these escaping slaves? Well, in early 1862, a general in Virginia, a fellow by the name of John Dix, he's faced with, well, we barely have enough food to feed the soldiers. We can't feed all these folk. We can't house them, clothe them. Here's what we're going to do. I want to, and he actually requests permission from the War Department to do this. He wants to contact northern governors to talk about setting up refugee camps in northern states to have them fed, clothed, employed, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The very thing that a lot of northerners, in fact, before the war, most northerners feared was that blacks would be migrating north, taking their jobs, you know, all of that sort of thing. Even Governor John Andrew of Massachusetts, even though he's an abolitionist, he makes a trip down to Washington to tell Lincoln personally that he is not to consider Massachusetts to be essentially a dumping ground for escaping slaves, because that plays right into the hands of Northern Democrats, who are saying, "Look, if you vote for these Republicans, they were typically referred to it as the Black Republican Party, then you're going to have blacks voting and holding office and migrating north and taking your jobs." And Andrew says, well, what Dick's plan plays right into the Democrats' hands, so you're not going to do that. In fact, there was one Massachusetts newspaper that said forthright that that Massachusetts does not want these escaping slaves. No northern state wants them. And so a lot of people are saying, well, what are these folks escaping from to begin with? Well, they're escaping from slavery. Well, maybe if we give them freedom in the South, maybe they'll stay in the South. Hmm. So that gets sort of the wheels turning in the minds of a lot of Northerners about, well, maybe slavery was it is something that needs to be done away with, just for the purpose of preserving the Union, and secondarily, in some sense, but primarily to a lot of folks, keeping black folk in the South. Another difficulty that Lincoln's facing, aside from all of this confusion about what do we do with these tens of thousands and eventually hundreds of thousands of escaping slaves, by the time we get into spring of 1862, Northern recruiting is on the way. There's not a lot of volunteers anymore. South is looking at the same difficulty as well. And the Confederacy responds to that by instituting military conscription. Lincoln's reluctant to do that, knowing how unpopular it's going to be, because it's pretty clear it's unpopular in the Confederacy as well. But from the beginning of the war, blacks had been trying to volunteer for the Army and had been turned away. The Army had a policy that blacks could not serve in the U.S. military, but their manpower is very much needed. So it's largely this combination of the need for black manpower, the confusion over the legal status of these thousands of escaping slaves, along with other issues like diplomatic recognition for the Confederacy from Britain and France that might come as long as slavery was not an issue in this war, that sort of begins to turn the tide in the spring and summer of 1861, leading Congress in July of 1862, leading Congress in July of 1862 to pass the Second Confiscation Act, which basically said that any any slaves escaping from Confederate-supporting slaveholders would henceforth and forever be free. And they also, at the same time, passed a Militia Act, which didn't say anything about the color of soldiers' skin, which essentially was giving Lincoln permission to recruit black soldiers for the Union Army because their services were so badly needed. The problem with the Second Confiscation Act, from Lincoln's perspective, he did sign it into law with some reservations, a couple of reservations. He wasn't sure how white Northerners were going to react to this. Because he feared that there would be a backlash, which there eventually was. He also was concerned about how do you enforce this. The act applied only to Confederate supporting slaveholders. Now there were still lots of slaveholders in Missouri, Kentucky, Maryland, states that hadn't seceded from the Union. And there were also slaveholders, of course, in Tennessee. By that time, most of Tennessee was back in Union hands. Southern Louisiana was back in Union hands. Parts of Northern Virginia, coastal regions of South Carolina, Florida, Georgia. Did the act apply to those slaveholders? It only applied to Confederate-supporting slaveholders. And so what's Lincoln going to do to enforce this? Is he going to put every slaveholder on trial and to determine whether or not they supported secession or not? Well, that's going to be kind of unwieldy. So essentially this is what he comes up with, which becomes the Emancipation Proclamation, largely as an enforcement mechanism for the Second Confiscation Act. And he says this right in the September 1862 preliminary proclamation, as an enforcement measure for the Second Confiscation Act, I'm just going to say, as of January 1st, 1863, any slaves being held behind Confederate lines, we're going to assume those slaveholders to be Confederate supporting, and all their slaves will be free henceforth and forever. As Lincoln had anticipated, and he does this to some extent a little hesitantly because he fears a backlash, and sure enough, there's a huge backlash in the November elections, the midterm elections, 1862. Democrats retake the House of Representatives, or gain seats in the House of Representatives, and they may have gained seats in the Senate as well had senators been popularly elected at the time. Didn't become popularly elected until the early 20th century. But anyhow, even the Emancipation Proclamation isn't enough to draw enough troops into the Union Army. So by the spring of 1863, with the midterm elections behind him, and he's hoping the backlash is behind him as well, he does ask Congress for a conscription act, military draft. And when in the summer of 1863, when Lincoln tries to enforce the draft, there are draft riots all over the North. And although we call these draft riots, they're largely race riots as well. In Boston, of course, the biggest one in New York, but there are also disturbances in Chicago, most of the major cities in the North, a lot of the smaller ones. Blacks sort of become the target of this white northern backlash against making the war, even in part, a war against slavery. So Lincoln's kind of having difficulty about, you know, whether or not he'd done the right thing. To one colleague, he admitted that, well, I had hoped that the Emancipation Proclamation would sort of inspire the nation. He said, but I think it's done as much harm as good and maybe more harm to the Union war effort. But on the other hand, the effort to try to preserve slavery and preserve the Union at the same time, I think Lincoln was coming increasingly to recognize that that was just an impossible effort. Because if slavery survived the war, well, sure, the Union might be preserved temporarily, but the issues of slavery generally, slavery expansion in particular, you know, those issues were still going to be there. They weren't going to go away. And would this result in some future civil war if slavery remained intact? And what about the slaves themselves? I mean, they're continuing to escape the Union lines at every opportunity. And that's where the real pressure for emancipation and ultimately the 13th Amendment is coming from. And it's not just these escapees. People who are behind Confederate lines, still held presumptively in slavery, they're taking every opportunity to undermine the Confederacy and slavery in particular. Slaveholders are having an increasingly difficult time keeping control of their slaves. Slaves are beginning to demand wages for their work, escaping in larger numbers. But in some areas, not even having to escape to essentially act as if they're free. They, again, demand wages for their labor, saying, well, look, if you don't pay me wages, I'm just going to escape the Union lines. Or if you don't give me, more food, better clothing, better house, that sort of thing, making demands on slaveholders increasingly. Escaping not to the north, but to cities in the south, and becoming wage earners. Undermining the Confederacy by helping Confederate deserters get back home, helping other slaves escape, and that's a significant undermining factor because there are so many slaves escaping. There's so many. By 1863. Close to half the Confederate Army is deserted. By 1864, two-thirds of the Confederate Army is absent with or without leave, and Jefferson Davis himself publicly admits that. And a lot of these escaping deserters are getting back home with the help of slaves. So it's not just escaping slaves who are undermining the Confederacy. It's people who are presumptively remaining in slavery who are essentially assuming freedom for themselves, undermining the Confederacy. And so really by the Confederacy really is fighting a two-front war, largely from the beginning. There's this war against the North that we always hear about, but there's also that war within the Confederacy that we rarely hear about. With blacks undermining the Confederacy at every turn, helping the white deserters and layout gangs and deserter gangs in the process. And it's the Confederacy just finds it impossible ultimately to survive this two-front war.
Mm-hmm. Did the Confederacy make any attempts to police these areas where newly emancipated, I put emancipated in quotes because I doubt the people who owned them thought they were emancipated,
This is another thing that undermines the Confederate war effort, because slaveholders back home demand that men be kept at home to serve mm-hmm. on slave patrols to keep slaves in check, to keep slave resistance down. What that means is, the Confederacy doesn't have enough men to put in the army. It's kind of short on manpower as it is. And by one estimate, at least 200,000 whites are kept back home to try to keep slaves in sort of a vain effort to keep slaves under control. So that's another thing, another way in which resistant slaves undermine the Confederate war effort.
Mm-hmm. And what do we know about this attempt? I'm just very interested in this attempt to, you might think of it as like anti-partisan activity. what do we know about the way in which that was organized?
I wouldn't say that it was organized in the sense that we think of organization.
Mm-hmm.
These were largely spontaneous acts that slaves had largely always, taken advantage of. Pushing freedom to the extent that they could. And it's, during the war, they can push it to a much greater extent, because so many whites have been drawn off to the war, women left at home to try to control slaves,
mm-hmm.
And some doing a better job than others, but largely slaves taking advantage of the opportunities presented to them to claim bits and pieces of freedom, even though they're not called free at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Slaves behind Confederate lines are largely acting as if they're free long before the war is over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what we know about, and I doubt it's very much, the ways in which the black communities themselves talked about people who emancipated themselves and went north. Because, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, it's sort of a paradox. You need to stay with your family. But on the other hand, you want to go and emancipate yourself and contribute to this great cause, which is the freedom of the race.
Well, that's largely why you find, you know, some slaves stayed at home because they don't want to leave their families. Others, mostly young, unmarried, although I use the term marriage, you kind of have to use loosely because slave states didn't recognize slave marriages in any official capacity, although they slaves themselves recognized marriage within their own communities. But you know, many were married, had children, you know, didn't want to leave, but they could help those who did want to leave. They sort of operated what we would call the Underground Railroad. This, and the deeper south you went, the more unofficially that operated, helping whites escape to the north who wanted to avoid Confederate entanglements, helping deserters get back home, helping Union prisoners of war escape to the north. So largely undermining the Confederate war effort in any way they could, even though they were still
mm-hmm.
presumptively held in slavery.
Yeah.
But certainly not acting like it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At the end of your book, you talk about, I don't know what to call it, a broken promise, I suppose, that they were encouraged to emancipate themselves, and then they were emancipated, and they acted as if they were free. And then the Union won the war, and then things didn't improve much.
In a legal sense, that's slow in coming. In a practical sense, it barely comes at all. With the end of Reconstruction, with Northern congressional efforts to try to guarantee black voting rights, all but made null by the Ku Klux Klan, and Congress sort of by the early 1870s saying, well, okay, if you feel that, you white Southerners, if you feel that strongly about it, you know, fine, we won't try to enforce black voting rights or black civil rights in the South. We'll just withdraw our armies of occupation, and you can do with blacks as you will. And largely this has to do with a shared sense of white supremacy between white Northerners and white Southerners.
Mm-hmm.
White Northerners had, while they had been willing to go to war to preserve the Union, most white Northerners had never really felt comfortable fighting the war on behalf of slaves. I mean, eventually, most white Northerners came to the point that they said, well, if we don't do away with slavery, then the issues of slavery's expansion are still going to be there, and we don't want any future war over this. So, yeah, maybe we ought to do away with slavery. But fighting the war on behalf of blacks was not something that white Northerners were ever terribly excited about. And so, returning whites to, or returning blacks, or allowing Southern whites to return blacks to a state of peonage was something that white Northerners were not terribly uncomfortable with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it's sort of this shared sense of white supremacy between white Northerners and white Southerners that contributes to blacks sort of been, to some extent, re-enslaved mm-hmm. by things like the convict lease system, in which blacks could just be arbitrarily arrested and leased out to big landholders who would literally worked them to death because they had nothing to lose now. They were not they weren't property. They couldn't be bought and sold.
Mm-hmm.
They could just be worked to death and get another convict. Or in a larger sense, in the sense of sharecropping and particularly tenant farming, that some historians refer to as the new slavery, because it's largely a debt slavery. Blacks become indebted after the war to white landholders who control the price of any products they get, the interest rates that they pay, and so just can perpetually keep them in debt, making it illegal for them to leave. Mm-hmm. I remember one former slave said, well, you know, Tennessee was much like slavery in that if you wanted to get away from it, you had to escape.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. David, we've taken up a lot of your time, and I really appreciate it. And I want to thank you for writing I Freed Myself, African-American Self-Emancipation in the Civil War Era. I want to conclude the interview by asking you to address our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm kicking around a couple of ideas. Mercer University Press has been after me to do this for a while. It's been more than 60 years since anyone did a general overview of the state of Georgia during the Civil War. So I'm going to be working on that over the next couple of years. Then I'm not sure what direction I'll go. One thing that has kind of really intrigued me has been the food situation in the South, that planters were growing way too much cotton, not nearly enough food. Food prices were skyrocketing, resulting in food riots, particularly conducted by women all over the South. Mm-hmm. Most people have heard of the Richmond riot, but there were dozens of riots throughout the South that not a lot of research has been done on, so I'm thinking about something along those lines in the future. But we'll just see where that goes.
Mm-hmm. Well, good luck with those projects. And again, David, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Absolutely. And let me say to everyone who listens to New Books in History and the other podcasts in the New Books Network, thank you for tuning in. If that's what you do, I'm not sure what you do in the age of podcast downloading, I guess. But in any event, I hope everybody has a great week.